Andrew Talks to Chefs is an independent podcast. For current and past episodes, Andrew's blog, contact information, and more, please visit andrewtalkstochefs.com. To support us, please visit patreon.com/andrewtalkstochefs. Enjoy the show.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
This is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs.
At 18 years old, I was like, I'm going to go and have Uncle Sam pay for my culinary school. I said, Uncle Sam's going to pay for me to go to the CIA, but I'm going to sail the world for a few years and cook for admirals on a ship. This was like my dream, to learn how to cook in volume and be able to do stuff in like just under crazy conditions. Unfortunately, I have asthma, and so that prevented me from being in the military. You couldn't bring an inhaler into basic training. So that's when I set out on a path, and I literally hitchhiked across the country and begged my way into jobs.
That is the voice of Chef Joshua Smith, Director of Culinary Innovation for All Town Fresh. He is our guest today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. It's gonna take a full long arrangement of the senses to
make some sense of this.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman. Our guest today is Joshua Smith, Director of Culinary Innovation for All Town Fresh. And I will explain what All Town Fresh is for those of you who may not be familiar with it in just a moment. I do need to apologize to Joshua, who drove a long way to see me a couple of months ago now. I got a little over-enthusiastic back in the late summer and early fall when all of a sudden the weather was nice, the COVID positivity rate in the New York area was hovering around 1%. It was very easy and I think very safe to do distanced outdoor in-person interviews, which I had desperately missed. Joshua drove, like I say, quite a distance to come see me in order to do the interview in person. And you know, I just banked more interviews than I could get up on air in a reasonable amount of time. But I am getting everybody who interviewed with me this fall up on the air before Christmas. I'm airing Joshua this morning on Wednesday, the 23rd of December. Then this evening, I'm going to drop an episode with Charlie Palmer, the legendary American chef, who has been a guest of this show before. We had an interesting check-in with his observations about what the industry is facing right now. I think that will be an interesting listen for a lot of you. And then on the 24th, Thursday, I'm going to be dropping a holiday special with a handful of guests, most of whom are familiar to longtime or recent listeners of the show. It includes our first Shelter en Place review with Allison and Matt Robicelli in some time. It includes a conversation with Chef Dan Kluger of Loring Place Restaurant in New York City about his wonderful cookbook, Chasing Flavor. It includes a conversation with my new friend who I met doing this show, Eric Williams of Virtue Restaurant in Chicago, and a first-time guest, but an old friend of mine, Harold Moore, who many of you may know from his time as chef owner of Commerce Restaurant in New York City, and he's highly entertaining. That's all going to be up on the air before Christmas, and then I'm going to take a break for a week and see you all back in the new year. This episode, though, is devoted to Joshua Smith, and Joshua is currently the Director of Culinary Innovation for All Town Fresh. All Town Fresh is a collection of markets along the northeast corridor of the United States. They do groceries, prepared foods, catering, coffee. They're all connected to, I mean, basically, I hate to put it this way because it kind of, I think, brings down what your expectations of All Town Fresh might be, but they're part of gas stations, you know, but they're elevated in the way, if you've been to Italy, something like the Auto Grill is incorporated over there. It's of a much higher standard than we as Americans, I think, are conditioned to expect from that setting. Joshua is someone with an incredible amount of training over about 30 years, and he has a fascinating story. He grew up in New Jersey and North Carolina, After he discovered his love for the kitchen, he spent 8 years, and I'm not advocating this next part, nor does he, but he spent 8 years hitchhiking around the United States seeking kitchen knowledge, looking for jobs, following, as many young cooks do, a curriculum of sorts in the kitchen that he was assembling himself as he went along. He eventually fell in love with charcuterie and had a wonderful business called New England Charcuterie that was affiliated with another business of his, Moody's Delicatessen and Provisions. He is no longer with those businesses. That was in Waltham, Massachusetts. And he has now, for a while, been with All Town Fresh. He's got a great personality. I really enjoyed getting to know him. No disrespect to Joshua. I imagine many of you listening to this may not know his name, although if you're in the industry, you may be familiar by reputation with New England Charcuterie, which a lot of people, you know, really felt did incredible work when he was at its helm. But his story, I think, is one that from the first minutes of this dialogue, you are going to be fascinated by. So with that, and again, Joshua, my apologies to you and my appreciation for your patience in waiting for this to get up on the air, I'm going to get right to my conversation with Joshua Smith. Here you go. Okay, so Joshua, welcome. Welcome to my humble abode.
Thank you. Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thanks for making the trip. Can I say this publicly? We have to give a thank you to the Bennos, Jonathan and Liz Benno, for hosting you last night.
Absolutely, absolutely.
As longtime listeners know, they're just up the street. They're mutual friends of ours.
Yeah.
And you made the trip last night and crashed there, so you just strolled over this morning.
That's right. Yeah. We went out for a little walk this morning, and I just detoured and came here.
It's perfect.
To enjoy this.
Perfect. So thanks for the effort it took to be here. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
So listen, I want to talk about what you're up to now, but first I want to get your story.
Sure.
Since you're a first time guest here. You're from North Carolina, correct?
Yes, sir. Born and raised in Charlotte.
In Charlotte.
Yeah.
And what was North Carolina like as a kid? I don't even know what Charlotte's like, if I'm honest.
So, you know, I was born in Charlotte, and at 6 months old, my parents moved me to New Jersey. And we lived here, we're in New York.
Tri-state area.
We're in the tri-state area. So I lived in New Jersey for about 10, 11 years.
Oh.
And so my father worked in the city, he was in textiles, so in and out of the city for the first half of my life. And then we moved down south to do schooling, you know, all of the, you know, junior high school and all that. When we moved back down, there was a kind of a big exodus from the north. To, you know, the Yankees going down south to, you know, money went further, more land was being developed. Charlotte was becoming like kind of a banking center.
Mm.
So it was really cool. It was wide open, you know, started, you know, going from the city and kind of an urban sprawl like we have up here down to, you know, riding motorcycles and hanging out, you know, chewing tobacco and being in the backwoods all the time. It was quite the culture shock from, you know, from wearing like Cavaricci pants and,
uh-huh.
you know, hanging out, you know, in these sort of like isolated sort of neighborhoods, you know, up
yeah.
here it's, you know, it's very segregated kind of from, you know, like the neighborhood I grew up is a bunch of Jews and Italians, you know
right.
what I mean? And down there, it wasn't the case. It was a huge melting pot of like kind of everybody in these like neighborhoods that were relatively brand new, to be honest with you. We lived kind of out in the woods, out Providence Road. So, the food scene was, minimal at best.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
And what was your, I mean, growing up, what was your, you know, because we've never really talked at length before. I did a little reading up on you before. I know you were interested in kind of the more or less the path you set out for yourself from a pretty young age. But what was your interest in food as a kid? Were you a foodie kid? Were you someone who just liked to eat? Was your family into food? Where did it figure into your life?
So food figured into my life. My mother, growing up in New Jersey, would, you know, cook a lot. And we went to fish markets and, you know, butcher shops and got great food. And she was a really good cook. When we moved down south, her relationship with my father deteriorated. And I never really had one. So they split when I was in high school. And it became sort of the need to eat, to be honest with you. So my mom left with my two sisters. And my dad basically said, I don't have time for you. So if I needed to eat, I needed to cook myself.
Wait, so in the divorce, your mom and your two sisters went to one, were one household, and you and your dad were the other?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so my father was like, he literally told me, I don't have time for you. I was like, okay. And he goes, if you need anything, call your grandparents. My grandparents are great. My grandmother's a great cook. You know, she's a mensch. You know, I started, you know, my buddies in school were working at McDonald's. And so I got a job sweeping the floor at McDonald's, and I was like 15 years old. And then at 16, I started cooking eggs on the weekends and helping make biscuits. I mean, we were cracking fresh eggs and making fresh biscuits.
At this McDonald's.
At McDonald's in North Carolina. Yeah, it was really cool. You know, people sort of would poo-poo that now. But, I mean, at least back then, maybe, maybe the, just my lens was different. It seemed fresh and great. We loved it. I cooked breakfast on the weekends, and I just started kind of falling in love with it. And my friends from there, you know, sort of graduated over to this place called New Market Grill. And it was just, you know, there wasn't a chef, there was a kitchen manager, and it was, you know, your basic menu with chicken fingers and fettuccine Alfredo, you know, the basic American fare.
Was this all stuff that came out of a bag or?
No, it was fresh. Like, we were literally taking chicken breasts
and cut.
Yeah, everything was scratch, but it was scratch kitchen, but it just was expected. I mean, you know.
Right.
The pasta wasn't scratch, but, you know, the pasta came as DiCicco.
Right, but I mean,
something.
You weren't, like, opening, like, food service bags of, like, frozen crab cakes and, like, all that stuff.
No, everything was made.
And, things. Right.
Yeah, it was really cool. And I remember working for this guy, Abel, and he was a French Frenchman, and that was my introduction to the French ways of doing things, really meticulous. And I was washing dishes and prepping. And anyway, just that's, it kind of started me on that path. So the need to feed myself and the need to, you know, actually feed myself with, you know, financially. So it kind of took off from there, and I ended up, like, I couldn't stand living with my dad. So I ended up lived in a farmhouse. A lot of my friends, so like one of the managers from McDonald's.
At what age?
16.
You moved out at 16?
Yeah. So it was just really super broken home, just like crazy, you know? And so I ended up living in this farmhouse in Weddington, just outside of Charlotte, so a little suburb, it was a little town. We lived down Reed Dairy Road, and it was really, really cool. All my buddies, like the older guys, they were they went to Paris Island. So as they were going and coming, they're all Marines because we're down there in the South. So everybody kind of had a different path, and some were Marines, some were cooks, some were managers at McDonald's, some were servers at New Market Grill. And so it was like this little kind of subculture of folks that you know, sort of took me in, and I just was like riding on couches. And so it was quite the journey from a young age.
Wow. Is this too personal? This sounds very tumultuous, what you're describing. Seem like a fairly confident, sturdy person. I don't know what you were like as a kid, but was this hard for you?
It wasn't easy, but I don't like use it as a crutch.
Right, so, but I mean, at the time, was it?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it was terrible. You know what I mean? But at the time, I didn't think, like, oh, my God, this is terrible. I just thought, like, my mentality was always, if you have nothing to lose, you have everything to gain. And so I always, and I'm getting personal and telling you this because it sets the stage for what created the drive in my desire for excellence. And so I always identified with some sort of male figure of discipline in my life. And so I've always... whatever the chef wanted was what I did. It was always yes, chef. It was never questioned. You know, it was like, great. And so I would always be the first one there and the last one to leave. I've always pretty much worked two jobs. Like, you know, even at New Market Grill, I'd work overnight cleaning the hoods because I wanted to go see a Grateful Dead show. So I had to save up money. So I'd clean the hoods with this guy named Crazy Steve and literally clean the hoods, sleep in the booth, and then, you know, get up the next day, wash dishes for the lunch service, help the prep guy get stuff done, and either work the fry station that night or, you know, go home and, you know, get some sleep and do my thing. So it was like, and I didn't drive. I was just riding a bicycle everywhere. So I became really into cycling. So I rode a bike everywhere and I cooked as much as I could and asked as many questions as I could, had tons of notebooks, and just that's kind of what started the path. I couldn't afford culinary school. So that was kind of how I did it.
So when you're coming up at that age, first of all, I have to ask, what was life like in this farmhouse? Like, I mean, on
it was
the
crazy.
What it was.
Beer
was
cans
it
everywhere.
Party Central.
Like, yeah, it was not. I mean, these are Marines.
Yeah.
I mean, these are young 18-year-old, 19-year-old Marines in and out of, you know, boot camp and stuff. And these guys, a lot of them joined the Marines because they were kind of forced into it to, you know, get some discipline in their life because we were crazy. I mean, this was lots of fun, lots of, you know, crazy stuff happening. And I was able to kind of dip in and out of that. I never really, that never really motivated me. It wasn't something that I felt the need to, you know, be the guy that drank the most or did, you know, some of these crazy stunts you'd pull when you're, you know, 18, 19 years old.
Right.
I would say at a very young age, I was like super driven toward making sure I always had money in my pocket, was advancing in my career in some way, shape, or form, like just advancing myself. At the time, I didn't think of it as a career. I thought it was just what I did.
Yeah.
You know, like this is what I have to do.
And as far as the cooking went, what was it that, I mean, I understand it was money. And as you just said, I mean, you kind of fit a classic mold to some extent, right? There's, you know, we were talking before we started rolling about kind of the old school kitchen scene, especially in this, we're, you know, like in the tri-state area up here. I do think there are a lot of people who, mostly guys I would apply this to, who were drawn to kitchens. The way some people are drawn to the militaristic high school sports coach. You know,
right.
They wanted that surrogate father figure for whatever reason. They needed, whether they would recognize it or not, discipline. They wanted or needed somebody to please. I hope you don't take offense at this, but I honestly mean this. I do, there's an analogy I have, which is I've owned two dogs in my adult life. And when you get a dog as a puppy, they're kind of like, they have all this manic energy and they don't know what to do and they're, you know.
Yeah.
And they have accidents and they're like, when you teach a dog, and they call it obedience school, right? But
right.
When you teach a dog, sit, lie down, roll, just to fall in line, to do what they need to, when they're off the clock, they can do whatever they want. But when they're in your command, they become happier creatures,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Does this make sense?
It does.
To me, this is what I compare. This is what I see in a lot of young cooks of this type, right?
Right.
I'm not saying everybody out there, but there's a certain group of cooks. So I think when they come to the kitchen on some instinctual level, it centers them. It takes that chaotic energy away from them,
right?
And it puts them in a lane,
right?
Which is a good thing.
Yeah. It's not for everybody,
that
but you're absolutely
right. That
doesn't
seem like a crazy analogy.
Not to me, it doesn't. Not to me.
Okay.
It does not offend me. I mean, it would take a lot to offend me, to be very honest
okay.
with you.
But, yeah.
But I've been through a lot.
Yeah. Well, to be honest, I make the same analogy between that and raising kids,
yeah.
If I'm honest. I've made that in conversations.
Yeah, of course.
As I say that as a parent, you know.
Well, I mean, puppies are kids. Like, I have two.
Yeah.
I have two golden retrievers that I love so much. And, like, I treat them, you know, like gold. I mean, those are my babies, but they need discipline just like your child needs discipline.
Yeah.
Just like you need discipline as an individual.
Yeah.
You know, like we need it.
Yeah.
Discipline equals freedom.
I love that.
Right. That's Jocko Willink. That's not Joshua Smith. That's Jocko Willink. But discipline equals freedom. And it's a great mantra to have, because if you create discipline in your life, you will have the freedom to do what you need.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. Thank you for that. Okay. So there's that aspect of it.
Sure.
But what about food in general? Like, did you, like, even you said, you know, it came out of a need, right? You needed to feed yourself. But were you just fueling up, or were you starting to really, like, did you want to make yourself, I'm not saying nice, like, you know, you lit candles and poured wine and stuff, but, like, did you have a certain amount of taste, and were you trying to, like, actually, you know, please your palate and cook yourself stuff that was nourishing in more than just a nutritional way?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, I was very fortunate to meet some really great people along the way and work for some really great chefs. Most of them, I would say almost all of them, I'm still friendly with to this day, and I'm really proud to say that, because, you know, all these men influenced my life and who I am, and I've had the great fortune, a lot of them, to, you know, over the last 10 years or so, I built my own business and I've sold it last year, but I was able to feed them there. So, like, years later, guys I worked with 20 years ago, guys I worked for 20 years ago, was able to 20 years later feed them in my own spot. Like, I can't tell you how satisfying that was to just come full circle and be like, see, the effort you put in paid off. You know, it was like this kind of coming full circle, closing it up and saying, look, you know, I did the best I could with the tools you helped me, you know, develop. And so, there was a chef I worked for at this country club. I probably won't name names because I don't want to, you know, I don't know if that's appropriate or not, to be honest with you.
Sure.
Great guy. And I remember I was the garmage cook, and he let me look at he's from New York. he was at one point the chef at Tavern on the Green, and he was he let me go into his office, and this is right when computers are being introduced into kitchens. So everything was on paper, and there was all these books, and he would let me every day pick a book, and he would teach me or help me, guide me to make a different recipe, things that were interesting and applicable to the Garmage station that I was working. And God knows, if I tried to rush through mise en place or whether it was not right, he would throw the mise en place in the trash. Like, if I was doing a small dice on something, I distinctly remember him looking, finding inconsistency with it, throwing it in the trash, and preventing me from, you know, potentially being prepared for service. But it taught me to take my time and do it right, and speed comes with repetition. So, you know, that started really sinking in, and I, you know, he gave me a copy of the CIA textbook, and I just ended up reading it cover to cover. And
the New Pro Chef, that book?
Yeah, like,
oh, that's a huge green book.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and just practicing all the time the different things. Like, still to this day, I practice all the potato dishes because I have an obsession with the different ways. Like, I would say I'm classically French trained. In other words, like, I lean toward the French art more than anything else. I love the discipline that comes with it and the maniacal approach to, you know, crafting the food and no waste. You know, over the last, I'd say, 6-7 years, I became a little bit more into Italian food. I've always loved Italian food, but, you know, the real, you know, I spent some time going over to Italy and looking, but back then everything was the Pro Chef, the CIA. I had this dream at 18 years old. I was like, I'm going to go and have Uncle Sam pay for my culinary school. I said, Uncle Sam's going to pay for me to go to the CIA, but I'm going to sail the world for a few years and cook for admirals on a ship. This was like my dream, to learn how to cook in volume and be able to do stuff in, like, just under crazy conditions. Unfortunately, I have asthma, and so that prevented me from being in the military. You couldn't bring an inhaler into basic training. So that's when I, you know, sort of set out on a path, and I literally hitchhiked across the country and begged my way into jobs.
Wow.
Yeah, like, I remember this one job at the Four Seasons in Seattle at a very young age. I remember being in for an interview. Now, I have to tell you, it took me forever to get that interview. Like, I couldn't barely get past HR. Finally got in. Jose Chavez, I have to mention him because he was just, like, such a great dude, and he worked his way up in that hierarchy. And he's, like, listening to me, and it was great. And then the executive chef walked in, looked at my resume, and said, there's no 5-star, 5-diamond experience on here. And he threw it back on the table and walked out of the room. And as he's on his way out of the room, I looked at him and I said, there's nothing I can't do in the kitchen if not shown once. And he kind of just gave me that glance and kept going. And Jose, the exec Sue, he turned red and he's like, I hope you work as good as you talk. And I said, yes, chef. And I just, like, you know, it was great, you know. And anyway, so that was just
a bold statement.
Well, it was. I was, you know, 19, 20 years old, whatever I was, you know, and I was just like, just give me a chance. And that was always my approach. Like,
Were you that competent? You weren't overselling yourself.
Oh, I was definitely overselling myself. I was absolutely overselling myself. But I was confident that if you showed me, I could do it. You know, I might not know it. I might not know how to make a hollandaise at that time. But you just show me, I'm going to get it done.
Yeah. Well, that's,
you know what I mean?
No, but that's all you said.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly. So
can I back up for 1 second?
Yeah, yeah.
You say you were into motorcycles.
Yeah, dirt bikes, KX80.
Oh, dirt bikes.
Yeah.
Okay,
because yeah,
what
yeah.
I was going to say is, you know, again, you'll tell me if I'm getting too personal, but, you know, it's one thing to say I want to cook in kitchens. You know, you're on the East Coast. You're not all that far from, I mean, at the time you were coming, I mean, D.C. you could have gone to, or certainly New York, back up New Jersey, you would spend time there.
Right.
It seems to me like one thing to say, I want to learn how to cook. It seems to me like quite another thing to say, I'm going to hitchhike across the country taking kitchen jobs.
Yeah.
Why'd you do that? I mean, I could think of, from what you've said, I could probably think of 3 things off the top of my head that maybe would drive that decision. But what was it?
So what drove the decision to, you know, travel the country to learn was this desire. So, like, in my mind, the second half of my life was going to be in Chamonix doing charcuterie, butchering pigs, working on farms. But I couldn't, in my mind, go to Europe and without knowing where I came from. So I wanted to understand the different cuisines of the United States and the different cities and the different towns and the different everything. I wanted to know where Joshua Smith, you know, an American citizen, came from and how our food was influenced by what happened over there. And so that was literally what drove me until I was 26 years old, like traveling everywhere. You know,
starting at what age?
18.
You spent 8 years as a kind of, I mean, I don't mean this in a negative,
vagabond.
Like a vagabond.
Yeah, no, I never had a bed. I didn't have a bed till I was like 26 years old. Didn't have a car till I was 26
years old.
You
didn't have a home base?
Not really.
You didn't have like a home somewhere that you would return back to, like an apartment you were renting or a...
Well, in some, at times I took on like 6 month and year leases, you know, room or
right,
couch.
But in a town that you were planning to leave at some point.
Oh, yeah, no, there was no like... And I would try to go back home to North Carolina up for a visit to try and like reconnect with my father. And he, you know, he just never really wanted a son. He never wanted anything to take care of until I became a good enough chef where he could have me cook dinners for his friends and he could utilize that aspect. And then when he was done and I had to go. And so that was in, you know, that was always evident. So, but I was always like that puppy trying to go back and get the approval, but it never really came. So whatever, that's a bit weird to say, but it is what it is.
Well, again, that's an animal thing, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And but that was what always kind of possessed me to just serve these chefs loyally. Like, whatever it takes. Like, what do you need? I got you. I will take care of it. It will be done. You will be happy with my performance. You will mm-hmm. be happy for giving me this chance, for giving me this opportunity, for, you know, providing me the platform to perform. And I will execute it to the best of my ability. And that was always my approach. And so I always had this can do, you know, the answer is yes. By the way, what was the question? You know, we'll get it done. I don't care. It doesn't, you know, there's no time limit.
Was that shown to you? You're describing a very, well, a couple of things. You're describing a very intense attitude. You're very intense as you just, now you're smiling, but you're very intense as you describe it.
Yeah.
And in general, sitting here this morning, I don't find you particularly intense, you know, but as you're describing what you're describing, you're like channeling your younger self, right? Like you were very, you're getting very intense about what you were telling people.
It was like, the emotions start welling up and I get wound up, you know?
But was that something innate to you? Was that something you observed in kitchens and saw as a trait that was essential? Or was that something that an early employer, chef, sous chef, somebody who's training you or teaching you, indoctrinated into you?
You know, that's a great question. I don't think I've ever been asked that question. You know, I think it was adopted by me constantly observing and trying to get the best out of everything I saw around me, you know? And
so this was something you saw in the people who were succeeding in the kitchens where you worked?
Correct. Okay. Just that drive to, you know... There was guys at a young age, I was working at that Four Seasons in Seattle, and I saw guys just like cooking the fish perfectly and peeling the skin off, and then trimming the bloodline out and then serving it, you know, then rewarming it gently in a little bit of Bermonte and then before it goes on. Like just the approach to getting those things done, and that doesn't come easy. That doesn't come like that. That comes through practice and constantly trying and trying and trying. And so I was like, I want to be that good. I want to be that, you know, where I can, you know, enter into any situation and be an asset. Mm-hmm. You know, I was always like, I don't want to be the best. It was never like I need to be the best at everything. I just need to be great at what I do. And, you know, in turn, hopefully you become the best at your profession. And, you know, I remember going in one of my little sojourns back to North Carolina to try and reconnect with my father. I ended up getting a job at Dean and DeLuca. And that's when I got introduced to charcuterie. And that was like... That was just the coolest thing ever, to be very honest with you.
Yeah, no, that's like your life's work. Yeah, I want to get to that in 1 second, but I have to ask first, mm-hmm. okay? As a middle-class Jewish kid from Miami, Florida, there were two things my mother made me promise her I would never do. One was ride a motorcycle. The other was hitchhike.
Yeah.
What was the hitchhiking experience like? I mean, that is something that's generally considered... I mean, maybe back in the 60s and 70s, it wasn't as, you know, but then it became like, that's a danger, you know, that's dangerous. Did you ever, were there any bizarre experiences? Did it ever get scary? Was it something that made you, I mean, in hindsight, was it something you think was just an unalloyed great thing that you did?
Listen, it was reckless. I never felt scared, but I didn't always feel 100% safe, but I didn't really... Again, back to if you have nothing to lose, then you have everything to gain from all experiences. And so, you know, someone was looking out for me, and through random acts of kindness, people paid it forward to me. Like it just, and I've continued to do that, to do everything I can to help anybody in my sort of circle of influence to succeed or have an opportunity. But just for whatever reason,
it never turned. You said you didn't always feel safe, but it never turned.
There were some dark times. There were some things that were like, oh, you know what I mean? But
you were never in jeopardy or.
Not. Maybe I wasn't aware of it. Okay. That might have been, but maybe I was just so naive. But you know,
I would imagine be mostly truckers.
Was everything. So I remember taking. I couldn't get a ride, so I went from like Kansas City, Missouri, to Denver, and I got a Greyhound bus, right? Because that's a desolate stretch of road,
uh-huh.
Right? And I think it was on 80. And so I get out there, and then I took a bus to outside of Boulder and then got hitchhiked, and some chick picked me up, like, on her way to play. You know, like, she opened the back of her truck, said, where are you going? I was like, I just want to go, like, camp on a mountain and just, like, kind of, like, recenter myself. And so I did. I had, like, some, like, ramen and some like dry goods, and I literally sat up on top of a mountain, listened to Jerry Garcia, and was like chilling, trying to like figure out my next move, and went back down, ended up meeting like just total random acts of kindness. Met this guy, we're at a bar, we're playing, you know, playing darts. He ended up, you know, needed a roommate, he had a DWI, he ended up, you know, like he would drive me to work. Like, it was just like these random acts of these things that happened that you couldn't script, you couldn't forecast, things just happened. Like an electrician that did work at a restaurant, it was a Bennigan's, got a DWI, needed some extra cash. I went and lived there, helped me find a job, blah, blah, blah. You know, it was like, it's crazy, you know? So, you know, never really truckers. I was always lucky to get the right person going to this place, to that place, to this. And
right.
I met this guy, Will Ivey, who was like a grower in like Humboldt County. Like, we were in like Barstow or something, like, you know, outside of LA. It was like crazy, and like catching a ride with him up to San Francisco, where he had a niece in San Francisco. Like, so these like little episodes in my life that have played out, and I feel they'd be a great story one day.
I was just gonna say, did you keep a journal or anything?
I didn't keep a journal at the time, but I get into these spaces where I can just really, like, you kind of dig in the file cabinet and you can really recant like instances where it's just like memories that they're not always in the front of my mind, but you can pull them up and really recite with names and people, and, you know, not solely times, but like my timeline gets screwed up, I have to kind
of
write it out.
Yeah,
but it's
course.
Like, yeah, but you know what I mean, because you're like, this come first, that come first.
Yeah, that happens to that's everybody.
But like, no, but it's like crazy. And I've had these intimate conversations like we're having with friends and people like yourself that, you know, they're writers, they understand, you know, content. And it's a great story, and I'd love to share it one day on a larger scale, because I think it's fun, and hopefully one day it would inspire someone to take a risk, to take a chance, to say, hey, you know what, it's not that bad. You know, it could always be worse. There could always be things that are, you know, and so that was kind of my whole thing, like, whatever, you know what I mean? Like, tomorrow's a new day. Let's get after it. The only easy day was yesterday. You know, it's a Navy SEAL mantra, you know, like, let's keep going. Let's keep pushing. You know, let's not dwell in what we don't have or what didn't go well. Didn't
right.
go well? Good. Let's move on. Now more time to train,
right?
You know,
right. So, charcuterie.
Mm-hmm.
What you just mentioned, the Dean and DeLuca gig. what were they making it in house at that Dean and DeLuca?
So this is great, right?
And where does this fall in your going back and forth? Like, this is, you said this was at one point when you came back.
Yeah, so
this
so
is
I
like
went
early
back and 20s. I went back and forth to North. I must have been 20 years old. Back and forth to North Carolina, and. And so, I think 19 or 20. Anyway, I think it might have been 19.
So it's about... Right.
It doesn't matter.
That's fine.
Either way, not old enough to buy alcohol. So the guy that owned Longhorn Steaks bought Dean and DeLuca, opened up a flagship in Charlotte, North Carolina, Phillips Place at, you know, South Park. And it was a beautiful store and just epic. And I got a job there, and... the French chef that hired me, just a wonderful, wonderful man. He, hard driving, and he pushed me really hard. And one day, I remember I was doing the prepared foods case. So I was a prep cook, right? And the butcher didn't show up one day. And he's like, I need you in here. I said, yes, chef. So I go in there, and he starts teaching me. And I got to be honest with you, it's just something happened to me that day when I had to, like, you know, build the case, put it together, cut meat, take my scraps, make rillettes, make this chicholi, like all these different pieces that I, at the time I didn't really understand. And then so he started teaching me how to make pâtés. We made the pâtés. Like, he was like a master charcuter. He would never admit that. He would never He would never agree with that, but I've always referred to him as the master. And so
you mean he was just too modest to say that?
Yeah. He was just too modest. But he did it his whole life, right? He's a Frenchman, like, through and through, and that was, like, what he did. You know, when he came to the U.S., you know, like, a million years ago, like, he did charcuterie in L.A. for this company, like... That's what he did, and he has, like, his recipes, and it took him forever to share any recipes with me, and, you know, but I earned it, you know, and he'd have me eating, like, the raw force meat with, like, raw livers, and I'm, like, tasting it, and I was like, chef, and he's like, how do you know if it has enough salt, and you know what I mean? So, like, back then, we weren't using percentages like we would now, you know, it was just literally by taste, and...
Oh, really?
Oh, God, yeah. And so we were building this stuff, like, because his inherent ability with charcuterie was, you know... was true. And so he started teaching me. So we had like 10, 12 different terrines. Now, every day I came in, the terrines were presented in a case across from me. And so I would go over there and lovingly face the oxidation and I'd put them on a plate. And then this great, I'm going to say his name because I want to find him. And if he hears this, he needs to find me. His name is Scott Gilbert, one of the greatest bakers I've ever like encountered. Mm. Like just a genius with bread and a total savant. And so I would go over there and get a fresh hot baguette and I'd take my pate and I would eat that while I was set my case. And that was my breakfast. And I just like the feelings and the happiness that that brought me. And it was so simple and so clean. And so, you know, and to see people's face, like to take trim and I don't want to say waste, it's not waste, but it's like trim byproduct and then turn it into something three X the value of it and sell it and see people, you know, making people's day. And like, that turned me on to gourmet retail. That turned me on to like having individuals come in, the guest comes in and they're having a dinner party. So you set them up with pate that they may never have tasted or tried and this cheese and that. And so like that really is what's lit the fire to like, this is so cool. Like I had great discipline around cooking and, you know, running a line and being, you know, being a cook. But this was something that was, this was something that was like, you know, extraordinary. And it just resonated in my soul for some reason. And so at that point I said, that's all I'm going to do. And I remember getting all the way out to Seattle and there was this chef, like I went to all these different chefs and I had to like beg my way into an interview. And I would say, hey, I just want to do charcuterie. And they would laugh at me. And they're like, it's a dying art. I think at this point we just, I keep saying this, like I think we discovered soy sauce at this point. And you know, like food wasn't what it is today. You know, there was not the social media. There wasn't any sort of, anyway, it was so funny because that negativity that like, you're an idiot. What are you doing? Like, look at this foam. This foam is great. We're like doing cool shit. I'm like, no, like this is really cool. Like the old ways is what I'm all about. And, I remember working, trying to get a job. And they said, all right, well, you need to make money. You're on the road. So go work at the Washington State Convention and Trade Center. And the chef will hire you and you could be a hired gun, like a mercenary. I was like, awesome. So I went in there and I had done volume before. So I was like, cool. So I went in there and, you know, like cases of cantaloupe, you know, doing banquets of 1,200, 2,000 people, like just fruit platters for days, just create, you know, just tireless, monotonous, you know, fruit cutting and et cetera, and plate ups of like 3,000. And so, but anybody that talked to me knew I'd talk about charcuterie and I would like read about it and I would think about it. And at the time I had, you know, kept trying to get a job at Campagna. I had a magazine, Art Culinaire.
Campagna, New York?
No. This is in Seattle.
Oh, at the market.
Yes, sir.
Oh, I've eaten there.
Yeah, great place.
Yeah, it was great.
I think Daisley's still the chef there. But Jim Droman, great guy, he, you know, I would just go and ask for a job and there's, you know, nothing for me. Whatever, that's fine.
Isn't it technically Cafe Campagna? Well, am I remembering
cafe,
right?
Cafe's down low, then there's Campagna up top.
That's
so they
what
had like
is.
The kind
right.
of like higher
right, right,
end.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
then down low was the cafe.
Yeah.
And so I remember one of the greatest moments in my career was when the chef of the convention center says, you talk all this, you know, about charcuterie, show me what you got. And I was so nervous. And up until this point, Chef Charles was always kind of right by my side, like showing me. So I had to really develop something on my own. And I dug deep and I thought about it and I made it and I won. So he put me up against this guy who was like probably graduated CIA in like the 70s. Like this guy was like a G. Mm-hmm. And so he was running the Garmage program there at the convention center. And they let me do my dish. So I did 95 Ballantine of quail, you know, trussed and tied, stuffed. I made a force meat, stuffed it with, you know, foie gras and like Bing cherries because we were out there and, you know, in from Mount Rainier or whatever. And it was awesome. And so we sliced it, served it, and I had a couple extra. And I said, can I take these? And I remember running down to, you know, to Campania and serving those, getting a plate from the bartender and serving those to Jim Droman, who was sitting at the, he was sitting at the table right at the bar right there, just writing the schedule, whatever. And
I thought you said if somebody showed you something once, you got it.
Yeah, evidently not. Old habits die hard. So he wrote me on the schedule right then. And that was kind of like always my determination to, you know, just get it done. Like, what do I need to do? How do I get in here? How do I make it happen? And,
so
charcuterie was just like something that everywhere I worked, everything I did from that point on, from like 19 years old till, you know, so I was, what, 30 something when I, you know, started building my brand.
Yeah. So you just used the word when you talked about getting that shot, right? That you had not used or even implied the 30 minutes or so we've been talking. You said you were so nervous.
Yeah.
Was that an unusual sensation for you?
No.
No,
it was constant.
Okay.
Because I cared so much. Like, I didn't understand it for the longest time. Like, because I always had the confidence, but I didn't, right? So it was in me, but it wasn't. And I know that sounds kind of weird to say, but...
Well, to me, that means you had the drive.
Yeah. But I always felt like I could always learn more, do better. So I never had, it never consumed me where I felt like I had, like, I got this. I knew I had it, but I didn't know I had it. So I always, it kept me sharp. You know what I mean? That nerve, that extra edge kept me sharp, kept me, you know, you're a little bit intimidated. You're a little bit afraid. You're a little bit like, you know, how is this going to turn out? So you're just, you're not going into it like, oh, I got this 110%. And still to this day, I feel like I approach, I can't tell you how many dinners I've done, how many, you know, private events, things like that. I still get those, you know, that nervous, that like, you know, making sure everything's right, double, triple, quadruple check, make sure that, you know, we're on point.
Doesn't that, and this is a cliche, but doesn't that just mean you care about it? I mean, that sounds like a cliche, but I'll tell you something.
No, you're right. It does.
I don't think I've ever said this. I don't know if I've ever said this to anyone other than my wife, but, I get nervous before every one of these interviews,
right?
You know, and they're pre-recorded, and I get to edit them,
right?
You know, but I want them to be good,
yeah.
You know, I want to connect. You know, right. I want to. You never know.
You never know what someone's going to say. You're standing right in front of you.
And I feel like, you know, we're coming up on two. If you count our specialist reports on this show, we're coming up. You know, we're almost at. We've done like close to 200 shows, and a lot of them are double headers, and some of them are more. I mean, if I'm honest, somewhere buried in there, there's maybe three that I feel like were like, that wasn't like the best interview.
Sure.
That'll get you in the Hall of Fame, you know, like that percentage. But it's always a source of, I mean, it probably sounds weird, you know. But
not at all.
But I get unbelievably nervous before interviews, even with people I've met. You know, I did two back-to-back the other day with two people I know.
Right.
And I knew they were going to be good guests, but I was absolutely, I have to shake it off every time. I think it just means you want to do good.
And I couldn't agree more, you know, and to that point, I remember a story. So I keep saying at 26, everything changed. I met my wife, Tracy, who's just like, she means everything to me. And, you know.
Where?
So we met in Tahoe. We met in North Lake Tahoe, town called Truckee. I moved out there with one of my greatest mentors, Chef Dale Ray. He's just, you know, he's an unbelievable dude. And he was a huge figure in my life and has been best man in my wedding, blah, blah, blah. And he, and I don't mean to dismiss it like blah, 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 but you get what I'm saying. So, you know, my wife was an ex-pro skier. We moved back east to raise a family. So we're back here. We moved back to Boston. And, you know, I was like, Boston's great. I was like, I looked at my wife. I was like, I can do my job anywhere. And, you know, she was my fiance at the time. And so we came back here. And every winter, we have the pleasure to go back to Colorado, where she went to school. And we'd meet with her friends. And we'd go on a ski trip. So, you know, for like a weekend or 4 or 5 days. And I remember, I've never been to Aspen. We went to Aspen. And I looked at Edible Aspen. And in there, there was a picture of the chef, and he had all this like cured meat hanging behind him. There's Chef Ryan Hardy. And this dude, like, he's just such a G. And so I remember going home and calling him and being like, I would like to stage with you, blah, blah. And he's just, he was taken back. He was like, people don't ask that anymore. Nobody really does that, you know, especially at a hotel, at a Little Nell, like, you know. And he was just doing his thing. And so I was like, I'm really interested in charcuterie. So he accepted, you know, me to come do a stage. And I remember going there and driving there. And I called Chef Dale, freaking out, I was like so nervous. I was like, you know, and I had this at this point, I had a pretty good repertoire of products. I knew what I was doing. I understood, you know, percentage. I understood everything. Not everything. I had a good grasp of the craft. And I was like, I don't know what to do. Do I go in there and say, like, I know it? Do I just shut my mouth, blah, blah, blah? And he's like, just shut your mouth and listen. And I said, yes, chef. And so I went in there and I did. And Ryan and I struck up a great friendship. And for years after that, I would go stage with him. And, you know, obviously I see him when I come back to New York. He's now in New York. And just a great mentor. And I'll never forget what that man did for me by letting me into his kitchen to teach me. After the week of staging, he respected my ability enough to then hand me typed out recipes, which at the time wasn't something people did a lot of. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people were very protective of these sort of, you know, sacred formulas. And he said, listen, it's a dying art. Unless we share it and pass it on, it will die. And that always stuck with me. And so there's many people that are in the business now that I've taken every bit of my time and ability to share, and still to this day do, to help, because I want to see the craft continue to grow.
Right.
Even though I'm not practicing it anymore, it's not something I do. And it's like, you know, it means so much to me. But there's so many great stories of, you know, feeling that nervous energy and that nervous, you know, wanting to perform and do well. And there's, I don't know. I'm kind of rambling on here because I'm trailing off a little, but I'm sort of in that moment where it's like, wow, these guys were so great.
It's one of the things that I mean, I've said it before on the show, but you know, it's one of the things that really fascinates me about the industry that you're in is that it is a craft that you know, you can only get so much out of a book. Like, it is something that is passed down through mentorship, through, you know, you've talked a little in this interview, and I, you know, you hear it all the time. You know, the young cook comes in, you know, chef, if I come in early tomorrow, would you teach me how to do X?
Right.
You know, and I think that's, you know, there aren't many things that are like that. You know, there's very little you can't learn how to do on YouTube now.
Right.
You know?
Which I still haven't figured out how to use.
But it's, you know, that is something that's just so appealing to me. Before we move on and talk about your charcuterie business and then what you're doing now, I have to say, and this, I don't know which interview I'm going to air first yet, but I just interviewed the other day Ariel Arce, who has these champagne bars on McDougal Street in New York. She's got four of them now. She's done really well for herself. You know, we were talking about the moment when she realized that champagne was like the thing for her.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's kind of a quirky thing to say, I'm going to go all in on champagne.
I love it.
You know, I'm reminded of it talking to you, and I'd love for you to just speak to this for a moment, because I do not think that most people have this innately, right? Which is, it's really important if you're going to do anything that we would broadly call, I guess, creative, that if you want to be the creator, right, if you want to be the person kind of driving the process in a place of business, it's really important to be attuned to what gets you going.
Right.
And it almost, I think, like even you said when you were talking about, you know, you're like, I don't know what it was. I just charcuterie, like, it's, you know, we've used the word animal a few times, an instinct, you know, talking about like raising.
Sure.
I think there is something that it's like when you talk about people, like love at first sight, right?
Right.
There's something that when you recognize, when you feel that tug, when you feel that tractor beam, as idiosyncratic as it might seem, as weird as it might seem to others, it's really important to listen to that.
Right.
You know, like Dave Chang's one of the biggest names in the industry, right?
Yeah.
Now, when he first started that noodle shop, he was this guy who would work for like Daniel Boulud, and like people were like, what?
Tom Colicchio.
Yeah, it seemed weird, you know?
Yeah.
He was following something that only he could see.
Sure.
You know, and I think that's been most of the big success stories of the last several years, you know, the last decade or two.
Yeah.
Can you just speak to this for a moment? Because, you know, you were describing kind of, you know, you know, people thought it was a little odd, or like people told you it was a dying thing.
Yeah.
But you knew that there was something there. You knew that you could figure it out in terms of the technical piece of it. And you knew it was the thing for you.
Right.
Can you just, I'd love for you to just speak to this as in whatever way comes to mind without even thinking about it too much.
So, you know, charcuterie for me along the way just felt natural. It was such a nice, it's a nice way to start a meal. It's a nice way to socialize with people. And the one thing I love about our industry is, you know, making people happy. And it's such a way to display, like, there's so much flavor in one little slice, right? So to concentrate, to take your craft, to concentrate it down, to slice it thin and share it among large groups of people and to have that kind of influence. One of the things I love about it is that people, when they taste it, they think back to, it has these memories that come back. They think about their childhood. They think about maybe they grew up in New York and they went to a deli, or they went here, they went there. So it always resonates with people in such different ways. And so, you know, the ability to touch that many people and to have that kind of influence on with such a small amount, you don't have to eat like a giant steak or something, you know, but like people dig it, you know, and I always liked making people happy, and it looks beautiful, and it's such a craft because it takes waste. And I hate to use the word waste because it's not waste. No animal, we don't want to waste an animal's life, but you take things that are otherwise discarded or boiled into a stock, and you can make them into something meaningful and special and, you know, and carry on and completely honor that animal giving its life. And then in that end, now you've eliminated waste as much as possible, and you've created a product that people love that resonates with them in different ways and becomes something really special and a great way to set a stage or to begin an evening or a social event or just meet for drinks after work. It's such a great, it's a great thing to share and discuss and have fun with. And that, I think that was the thing for me. Like when we built our business, there was, you know, we had like 80 types. I took everything I'd ever learned and made everything I could, and it just displayed it. I wanted to have the most epic display because I wanted to just share it with everybody.
We should say the name of the business was New England.
It was New England Charcuterie and Moody's Delicatessen and Provisions. Mm-hmm. And so,
and this was in Boston,
in a town called Waltham, about 12 miles outside of Boston.
Right.
And you know, ironically, Waltham was kind of settled by a lot of folks from Calabria, from Italy. Mm. And great little mill town, working class town, super awesome. You know, it's kind of had its ups and downs over the years. And there was a little Italian shop by this guy, this landlord. And I just kind of had my eye on it. And I just go have an espresso with him and talk. And I was like, you know, rent me some space. Let me make sausage in the back. Let me do this. And just, you know, we're talking years. And I'm pushing my son in a stroller down the road. And I'm like, but, you know, at this time, I'm like now 30 years old, and I was just thinking, you know, I'm working, you know, working like crazy, man, and still, you know, decades later, right, or whatever, and I was like, if I'm going to work this hard, I want to do it for my family. Mm-hmm. And so I had a great job. I was gainfully employed as a chef and making good money and you know, a lot of great notoriety, a lot of great things happening in Boston, and I just told my wife that I was going to quit my job. And I was going to build a deli. I was like, I'm going to build a little deli because, like, again, back to that, like, childhood love of just nostalgia. And I was like, everybody loves a deli. Everybody loves breakfast is my favorite meal to cook. I was like, everybody, you know, breakfast and lunch. I could be home for dinner. That was, like, the original idea. And I could practice my craft, the thing that that's driven me my whole life. I can have a couple of deli cases of meats. I can make sandwiches, some great coffee, yeah, and then be home for dinner. And this was going to be the next chapter in Joshua Smith's life. And that's where it all began. It was crazy. And we just, like, I literally, you know, borrowed some money from my mother-in-law, took all our savings and just, like, we did it. And it was incredible. And people thought I was crazy because we built the first USDA inspected facility attached to a retail establishment in that area. Like hadn't been done. And when I went to the USDA, they could not have been nicer. And I said, I didn't know anything about it. I mean, I knew regulation and stuff, but not really.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, I had toured facilities, but no one really talks to you. No one really kind of shares they don't open up the book of kung fu to you. Mm-hmm, you have to kind of interpret.
Yeah,
and
sure.
So I got really, really lucky and met some really great people, and they were super supportive. And that's where it all began. And so in the back of this place, so a 1,200 square foot space, in like 200 square feet, we were producing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I had this oven rolling and we were making everything. I mean, we made, like I said, 60, 70, 80 types of charcuterie. And I mean, in everything, in charcuterie meaning like fabrication of meat. So everything from, you know, the 10 terrines I was talking about to salume to, you know, all the deli, like a full complement of deli meats, you know, anything you could possibly, you know, breakfast sausage, bacon, you know, pork roll. Now that I got to tell you, you know, living in Jersey, being introduced to pork roll, but not really carrying it into my adolescence or anywhere after that, I just sat there as a Jewish kid living in Waltham as from the South. I was like, I'm going to put pork roll on the menu, but I'm going to do it awesome, you know, and I'll never forget. I was playing around with it, and this is, you know, social media is out now, and I put it on Instagram, and I even got Tom Colicchio to make a comment about it, you know what I mean, which was like, I was like, oh, this is cool. If Tom says it looks good, then I'm on the right path, and because he's a true Jersey boy. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I took this. I wanted the bacon to fit perfectly on the sandwich. So I trimmed the bacon, had the bacon trim. So I used the bacon trim, used my breakfast sausage, combined them, port wine, freshly ground white pepper, maple syrup from this great farm up here in New York, from Crown Maple. And it was awesome. So we would like sour it. We'd like put a culture in it. We'd sour it. Then we'd fully cook it, cool it, and then sear it on the plancha. And the sugars and the maple syrup would caramelize. And we'd do the eggs like beautifully French, no color. And we made this sandwich. And so one day the right person tasted it. And I'll never forget. So, as I started building Moody's, I had an investor who became, you know, a friend who became an investor, and I'll never forget. And he said to me, he said, you know, we're doing like 8 covers for breakfast. It was just really pitiful, you know, like a month in. And he's like, you know, Josh, how many covers are you doing for breakfast? I was like 8-10 people. You know, it wasn't nothing meaningful. And he goes, do you think we should stop? You think we should just focus on lunch? I was like, no, it's going to be great. It's going to hit. This is awesome. People are going to hear about this. So I'll never forget, one day, someone at the right time, right place, tried the breakfast sandwich, and I ended up getting the cover of Boston Magazine with this breakfast sandwich, with a pork roll, Moody's pork roll sandwich, right? Like, I was like, this is awesome. And then the doors, you know, the hinge broke off the door, right. And they started coming in, and it was just really cool, and we became known for that, and it became like this thing. And so, like, this Jewish kid from North Carolina putting a Jersey pork roll, you know, it was just like, in my mind, I was like, this is so cool, and it was like... Still to this day, no one's really doing pork roll. There might be Taylor ham on a menu here and there, but it was a really cool moment to take something so simple and something that is probably overlooked. You know, as someone that lives in, you know, in the Northeast, you know, at least in Jersey, it's like, yeah, it is what it is, right?
Yeah.
But to try and make it as special as possible and, you know, really, you know, turn on the, you know, these true New England, you know, Boston folks onto this thing. It was cool.
Yeah. Good. Okay. So you eventually move on from the company you created.
Yep.
Tell us about where you are now.
So, you know, years into building Moody's, you know, we got approached for different projects and things like that. And we got approached by this company to potentially put, you know, Moody's or something like it in, you know, first it was airports and then gas stations. And I was like, that was interesting. And the airport thing was interesting, but not as interesting as gas stations because I felt like it hadn't really been attacked. Now, having lived in California several times throughout my life, that Pacific Coast Highway and the roadside, you know, tri-tip sandwiches and things, there's a great food culture along the highway there where even if it's just like a general store, you know, or it's, you know, like a true gas station with, you know, a couple of nice ladies in the back making, you know, burritos, it's like freaking awesome. So,
and we should say this is also like in Italy, for example.
It's a standard.
I mean, people... You mentioned, like, what is it, Auto Grill? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned that to people, and, like, their eyes light up.
Right. In Ireland, you know, like, all of them, all of the European countries, this is, you know, travel is something that people do. I mean, the Michelin Guide, right? It was meant to.
Right.
And so no one ever took a back seat when it came to food on the road overseas. So I was like, all right, well, that's interesting. We should really look at that, you know? And, you know, we sold the business. And I just started kind of evaluating, what's the next chapter? What do we do? What's a good way to apply this, you know, boundless energy and focus? So I took a job working with Global Partners, and you know, they started probably about a year prior to me getting there. This brand called All Town Fresh, And it's a spinoff of Alltown, which is one of the brands that, you know, that was started at Global Partners. And, you know, Global Partners as a, you know, wholesale fueling, things like that. It's a publicly traded company. But then they have a retail side where they have sites all throughout New England and all sorts of sites, you know, everything from like Extra Mart, Honey, you know, Honey Farms, things like that. So we started kind of looking at the portfolio of real estate and addressing the need for clean, fresh, natural, sustainable, locally sourced foods, conveniently prepared.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I just fell in love. I was like, dude, this is so cool. And so basically I started building these kitchens with this company where we have French tops. We have like Heston French tops and flat tops as a standard, you know, combi ovens, you know, CVAPs, you know, for hot holding, blast chillers for, you know, cooling. So we're maintaining the highest level of food safety and standards, working locally with, you know, we don't have any broadliners. It's all just, you know, local vendors. Like in this area, you know, we use Baldor and you know, Dairyland and people like that to get us the best quality products. And, you know, we train the chefs. So we hire chefs, we develop cooks, and we teach these guys. It's, you know, breakfast and lunch, fast casual. I mean, eggs are cracked to order. The bread is, you know, lovingly, you know, toasted, and, you know, we put like a nice local cheddar on it. You can, you know, add meat if you want. We use North Country Smokehouse Meats, who does a great job out of New Hampshire. Their bacon, and it's just, and we're constantly evolving and growing that piece. The salads are awesome. Like our Caesar salad is, you know, escarole, radicchio, and romaine. So give it the, you know, the unique contrast and different bite that you look for in those kind of chicories. And then we pickle our own eggplant, which goes in there, which gives some, and we do Parmesan, but we make Parm Frico. So we grate the Parm over, over a sill pat, bake it in the oven and crack it over there. So it's just like, it's a unique twist mm-hmm. on what you would expect. So if you go there and get a Caesar salad, and you can get chicken on it, and the chicken is seasoned with Labatt Espice. You know, we use the Shabazi spice and grapeseed oil, and we cook the chicken breast from Joyce Farms. Like, so anywhere we can find, you know, beautiful ingredients, we highlight and showcase. Furthermore, you can buy those ingredients in the marketplace that we curate in there. So if you're on the run, you got to go, you know, grab a few things on your way home from dinner, you can get the same ingredients. We can either prepare it for you, or you can grab the ingredients and add it to your, you know, to your pantry at home, you know, if you need some of these kind of unique pieces without having to walk through a, you know, 15,000 square foot, you know, grocery store. You
right.
know, it's kind of saving you time on all fronts.
So what's your, I mean, titles are somewhat meaningless, but what's your official designation?
I think they call me the Director of Culinary Innovation.
Of Culinary Innovation.
Yeah.
There
yeah.
you go.
Culinary Innovation.
That sounds great.
Culinary Change.
And
so.
And your purview, I mean, how many, are you able to say, like, roughly how many places are you working your magic on?
So right now we have six. We have six stores. We have three more in the pipeline. By the end of Q1, we'll probably have between 9 and 10 ready to go. The six that we have now.
And your fiscal year follows the calendar year?
Yes.
So Q1 is in the March.
Would be, yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, correct. And what a great anniversary that'll be. So, so we're kind of spread out all over. We have two in Connecticut, Hamden and Waterbury. Great stores, great communities. And that's one thing I've really fallen in love with this position is it takes me on the road. And so, like, coming down here yesterday, I got to go to Waterbury and see our team. And then, you know, after this interview, I'm going to shoot over to Hamden and see the team over there. So it's like, so it's great because, you know, I get to learn the area. You know, prior to what we're going through now, it was wonderful because I'd stay in little towns surrounding it and try to learn the community and understand what they want and find farms and find people that we can, you know, sort of showcase, highlight, support, and do things with, partner up with. Which I think is great, which is really the mission of what we're trying to do. You know, it's not like we're not going to come to Waterbury and do the same food that we're going to do in Plymouth. You know, Plymouth, we're going to, you know, showcase some cranberry and, you know, some seafood and things like that, which might not be the same or applicable in Waterbury. So we get to have a bit of a unique, there's a core menu, but there gets to be a unique edge or a unique twist in each of the different communities. Like we just opened in Schenectady, New York.
Mm-hmm.
Never been there. So I got to spend time in Saratoga and Schenectady and the surrounding areas. And, you know, back to me being a lover of cycling, you know, we were staying there for weeks at a time, you know, living in a hotel. And, you know, in the morning, I'd get on my bike and ride out these, like, there's awesome bike trails that go, like, for, you know, miles. I'd go, like, 30, 40 miles and just see the area. It's incredible.
Well, the other thing is this, I mean, it's so funny. This, I mean, all those years you spent, you know, knocking around the United States, I mean, you're kind of expert at, like, parachuting into a town and
yep.
meeting people and chatting people up
yeah.
and, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it kind of comes full circle.
It does. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And now I'm actually getting paid for it, so it's great.
Yeah, look at you. This is the biggest smile you've had the whole time.
Well, because I'm so inspired and I feel so thrilled to have this opportunity and to be a part of something so special. I mean, it's truly yeah. a revolution. It's truly like, you know, it's going to be a slow burn, but once it starts to take, you know, because it's, to this day, when I tell people what we're doing, they're still in shock. They don't understand. And I understand, because even though I try to explain it, but then they walk in the store and they have the experience and they
well,
see what we've done.
Yeah, I mean, it's because you say roadside and it messes people up. But I mean, we are getting there, you know, in this country. You know,
right.
I remember years ago, Howard Schultz, you know, who'd made Starbucks what it was, telling this story about, you know, I don't know if it was real or not. I knew Howard a little bit because I did PR for that company for a while. I think if he told it, I'm sure it was real. But, you know, he would talk about like a truck driver coming into Starbucks with a thermos and saying, can you fill this with latte?
Yeah.
You know, and that was when he knew that
yeah.
that's when he knew he was onto something.
Yeah.
You know,
it's real.
It's, you know, and yeah, of course, you know, I mean, especially the last 6 months, because I haven't gotten on an airplane. I've been just doing day trips or maybe an overnight more recently.
Right.
It's all car.
Yeah.
It's all car. And there, I do now, you know, there are places from over the years that I'll be going up the Taconic Parkway or something. And I'm like, oh, you know what? That's the exit where there was the place that had decent sandwiches.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
as opposed to like the pre-wrapped, you know, stuff that came from some commercial kitchen, you know, that wasn't any, you know, that was just horrible.
There's
you
no
know,
love,
that you
there,
might have gotten
no
out of a vending machine in another era.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I, it's very interesting. So how are you guys coping with, like, you alluded to it, this time we're in now? Like, how are you guys, I mean, on the one hand, I'm not asking for anything proprietary. I imagine, although we'd all like this to be over, like, I use myself as an example. I imagine business is pretty good out on the highways right now. But what about from a, you know, a safety and, you know, as much for your team as for the customers? How are you guys rolling with that?
So I've always had a real maniacal approach to cleanliness and sanitation. That's like first and foremost. Most people, you know, don't love how crazy I am about it, but it's like, you talk to anybody, they'll tell you like that's like first and foremost. And I think it comes from like doing charcuterie, running USDA plants. Everything needs to be surgical. So adapting to the standards was no adaptation. It was like just, it was what we did, you know, touchless hand sinks and, you know, every, you know, just changing out sanitizer all the time, wiping down surfaces, like really keeping the masks were new. The masks were different. We were always gloving up and, you know, being smart that way. But, you know, wearing masks has been we embrace it, but it's a challenge, you know, tasting food and
yeah,
trying to make sure that as you're, you know, doing things. So, but that's fine. We adapt. You know, at first it was really hard. People were nervous. And, you know, because as you know, in kitchens, it's tremendously difficult to socially distance, especially mm-hmm. when you're in a tight space. So we made adaptations to the menu and tried to make sure that everybody felt safe and had the right tools and PPE to feel safe. And I will say that Global as a company has done such a tremendous job. I mean, they care about their people. They're a family first. I mean, they were founded by a family and you know, and I'm so proud of the efforts that they put in. We didn't lay anybody off. You know, obviously people's hours got adjusted, but man, we kept everybody working and we were all deemed essential and we got after it. And, you know, essential workers that were driving to work and doing their thing, we kept their cars fueled. We kept their coffee hot. We did everything we could to just keep everybody happy and safe. And, you know, they worked really hard to, you know, put up the plexiglass and do mm-hmm. all the different, you know, sort of recommendations that the CDC had said. And, you know, they've changed all the time and we tried to adapt and stay as current as possible. And we're sending out guidelines, you know, at one point, it was like on a daily basis, almost hourly. The guidelines are changing, and we're just trying to adapt and make sure that, you know, our team, our staff, we have a lot of people in the field, and so it was a tough time, but we got through it, and we got through it because we had great leadership
mm-hmm.
From Global, and you know, after that, you know, the business started picking back up. Because just like you said, once, you know, once the summer hit, people kind of got a little stir crazy. They want to get back out, and they got in their car, and we started becoming able to feed them and earn their trust. And we're still letting them know, like, you can come in the store, we'll take care of you. We started curbside pickup, and, you know, with our distribution partners, they got jammed up with restaurants closing and they had inventory. So we started coming up with, like, protein kits and vegetable kits. We came up with a produce crate. So if you didn't want to wait in line, because they were only letting certain people up where we are, as Market Basket and, you know, places like that, if you don't want to wait in line, we'd put together a produce kit for you and bring it to your, you know, bring it to your car. You can order it online, bring it to your car, have a nice day. Protein kit, same thing. It would be like, you know, a whole array of, you know, chicken breasts and just basic stuff, you know, bacon and stuff. Again, all ingredients we use.
Yes.
But we just had them retail packed. So we worked closely with our partners to get retail packs of this stuff. And we had a lot of great, you know, a lot of great success with that. And then we spun that into meal kits. So now, you know, you have, you know, folks like yourself that, you know, both parents are working, kids are homeschooling. Who's got time to go to the grocery store to get everything ready to prepare this? Like, your life's different. So what we just constantly tried to do was adapt to what the needs of our community were. And so putting together meal kits, taco kits, meze kits, things like that, that are like fun and interactive with the family. Like, I love the taco kit. It's really great. We have great chefs. They're just putting a lot of effort into doing this.
This is also fun for your team.
Right. Right.
It's something new. It's not just like time to, I mean, I don't mean to this sound, this is too much the other way, but, you know, it's not like time to make the donuts.
No, you're absolutely right.
It's like, let's create meal kits.
Right.
Right.
And let's do something special.
That's changing it up a little, and that's.
Right.
Yeah.
And let's adapt. And if the guest calls up and they want this, but not that, let's make it happen. The answer is yes. By the way, what was the question? And we put in systems to be able to do this on a scalable level across all the stores. And we're still evolving. You know, I've got people now calling, asking, you know, hey, Josh, I need a private chef. Do you know someone who can come cook in our house just to meal prep? And I was like, I'm going to do you one better. I'm going to have our gas station deliver you meal kits. They're like, what? I'm like, no, I got you. And so a couple guys we got to deliver stuff to, and they're like, wow, this is amazing. And it's like, literally, you know, when you think about the guest experience, and so we have, you know, we have the technology, we have the tools, we have the blast chillers, so we can, like, cook things perfectly, cool them, you know, keep them seasoned right, give them heating instructions, you know, and then they can go home and you know, heat the food up, which they're obviously more than capable of, and have a great meal, you know. And it's not something that sat in a hot box and, you know, kind of went beyond its quality threshold. So it's been such a great learning experience to continue to challenge myself on a daily basis and keep our chefs challenged, our cooks engaged, and, you know, serve our community to the best of our ability and get endorsed and have the support of Global to do so, you know, because this doesn't come. This is not easy, but they've committed to this. And so it's like, it's up to us to make it work, and it's going really well. And I couldn't be happier with it.
Well, listen, it's been, I mean, you know, we're at the same cookout. Not this year, but usually we're at the same cookout every Memorial Day weekend. We've never had a conversation remotely close to this long, so it's good getting to know you.
Yeah, thank you.
And I have to say also, you know, for all the people, and a lot of them are listening to this show, who are struggling right now,
right?
It is nice to hear the story of someone who at this moment anyway is, you know, making it work. So thanks for making the effort to be here. Thanks for
coming
on.
It's my pleasure. Thank you. Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Again, my great thanks to Joshua Smith for making the trek down to Hastings-on-Hudson, New York, to visit with me in my backyard. Joshua, I wish you all the best for the holidays. If you are driving around in the Northeast and you find yourself in proximity to an all-town fresh market during the holidays, check it out. If you think of it, shoot me a note. Let me know how you liked it. I want to thank, as we wind up the year, Sam Pellegrino, as always, for their support of this show. I'd like to thank After School Special for our music. Please do check them out. Their album, Double Barrel, Single Entendre, is available on iTunes. Please do follow us on Instagram. Our handle there is @ChefPodcast. And if you would please rate or review us on Apple Podcasts, it does help more people find the show, and we'd be grateful for that. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back sooner than usual with another episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs.